Hi, Gerwin Jones here with a new edition of From the Bookshelf. Today we are continuing to present excerpts from Insurgent Cuba, Race, Nation and Revolution, 1868 to 1898, by Ada Ferrer and published by the University of North Carolina Press in 1999. Ada Ferrer writes, "To distinguish between the 10 Years' War and the Guerra Chiquita is, in some ways, to draw an arbitrary distinction. Clearly, for many participants in the first insurgency, the Pact of Zanjón had not ended the war. Maceo's protest of Baragua challenged Spain's claim to pacification, and even after Maceo's departure, several lesser-known leaders, including black officers Rafael Fromé and Galindo, refused to lay down their arms and surrender as slaves. In particular, they were declined to return to the pre-war status quo. They fled their plantations in unprecedented numbers, and many of them joined the new movement against Spain. For some, peace without abolition and independence was no peace at all. And for them, at least, conspiracy and insurgency continued. In this context, it is easy to understand the claim made by two Cuban historians of the Guerra Chiquita, Francisco Pérez Guzmán and Rodolfo Saracino, argued that there was little difference between the two insurrections. Some of the protagonists and many of the key issues remained the same. On the ground, the new war even looked like the old one. Both were guerrilla wars in which tactics of evasion and the elements of surprise surpassed formality and ceremony in military significance. Small groups of insurgents moved through the countryside, attacking farms, rail and telephone lines, and occasionally Spanish fortifications, while the colonial army, about 15,000 strong, often followed in close pursuit. Both wars, moreover, were ones marked by the significant participation of people of color, free and enslaved. Less than a month after the outbreak of the new insurrection, Camilo Polavieja, Spanish governor of the eastern province of Santiago, reported to his superior that people of color do not cease to go to the enemy. Despite such outward similarities of form, the very fact that it came after the first rebellion and its treaty made this war different. At the end of the first war, the colonial government, in an effort to minimize the threat of future insurrections, created new settlements, poblados, of former insurgents. Many of them surrendered slave insurgents. These new communities of convertidos, those freed or pardoned by the convenio or treaty of Zanjón, were exempted from local authority and placed under the supervision of allegedly trustworthy former rebel leaders. This, the Spanish predicted, would win over the insurgents. Instead, the settlements composed of surrendered insurgents became ready and important centers of anti-colonial activity, where convenidos offered aid and support to insurgent leaders of color, including Emiliano Crombe and Jesús Rabí. Sometimes entire insurgent bands were identified as originating from one of the newly formed poblados, such as Botija or Hongo Solongo. At one point early in the war, the whole poblado of Botija made for the mountains to join the insurgency, and Botija residents also figured prominently in conspiracies discovered in other nearby cities and towns. Consistently, the members of the newly formed settlements lent active support to the new insurrection. Though many Cubans and Spaniards alike declared the island tired of war and ready for peace, when the new rebellion began, communities of former insurgents and former slaves again took up the banner of independence and emancipation, this time bringing with them the experience of the war recently ended. José, a former slave insurgent from El Cobre, for example, participated actively in the new rebellion, even though he had already won his own freedom through the Pact of Zanjón. In 1879, he became an avid recruiter for the separatist cause, targeting those workers still enslaved. He persisted, said officials, in, quote, spreading the most harmful ideas amongst local slaves. He was of the worst reputation, having killed two or three overseers as well as his owner. If the new insurrection attracted slaves who had earlier embraced the cause of abolition and independence, it also clearly appealed to slaves who had not taken part in the first rebellion. Their obedience had gone unrewarded, whereas their partner's rebellion had resulted in legal freedom. In Oriente, officials reported that those still enslaved continued to engage in passive resistance to work and refused to obey their owners and overseers. They wanted their freedom just like the convenidos. In some sugar regions, their resistance was sometimes less passive. They were, for example, said to have set fire to cane fields, chanting, "No freedom, no cane." After the start of the new insurrection in August of 1879, many of these slaves welcomed anti-colonial insurrection as a harbinger of their own freedom. Within the first 2 months of the rebellion, Paula Vieja estimated about 800 slaves had abandoned their plantations to join the rebels. Spokespersons for the insurrection, meanwhile, put the number of fugitive slaves at 5,000. Through the context of slave participation had changed as a result of the 10 Years' War and the Pact of San Juan, the forms that participation took did not differ significantly from 1868. Insurgents in 1879, like insurgents a decade earlier, regularly attacked plantations, incorporating into their ranks as many slaves as they could. Rebel troops notified area slaves of their presence by ringing certain patterns of shots in the air, and on that signal, slaves set fire and attacked the plantations. Then, when the rebels appeared, many fled, sometimes with the insurgents and sometimes on their own. As the War of 1868, most of the slaves who swelled rebel ranks served as non-officers engaged in menial and supportive tasks. Many were used as assistants or servants to rebel officers, as was the unnamed slave of Norma Faustino, who served as an assistant to Lieutenant Colonel Quintin Bandera, an important black officer in all three wars against Spain. Some were used as messengers or vianderos, individuals sent to forage for food. Few were able to distinguish themselves, as did one unidentified slave who led a group of 30 rebels in an attack on a sugar mill that left a Spanish volunteer dead. As in 1868, too, slaves could use the climate of terror and uncertainty created by insurrection to flee their plantations and not join the rebels. Often, runaway slaves organized themselves into maroon-style communities, sometimes providing food for insurgent camps and sometimes just for their own subsistence. Spanish military records make numerous references to these settlements. In December of 1879, Governor Paula Vieja reported the existence of an extensive zone of cultivation in the mountainous region between Songo and Mayarí, populated by approximately 600 fugitive slaves, formerly from local sugar and coffee farms. The zone now consisted of a small, independent estancia, or farm, outside the control of either colonial or plantation authority. Precisely because this insurrection followed a long and destructive one, fugitive slaves had a greater chance of survival because of the large number of abandoned farms where slaves could fashion their subsistence. In Alcobre, for example, a region where new insurrection produced massive slave fight, 366 farms had been abandoned since the beginning of the 10 Years' War. And that's it for today from Insurgent Cuba, Race, Nation and Revolution, 1868 to 1898 by Ada Ferrer and published by the University of North Carolina Press in 1999.